coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, good evening, everybody. Happy Tuesday night, and laissez le bon temps rouler for all of you out there in Mardi Gras land, in the motherland of Louisiana. It is Mardi Gras night, folks. Do not forget, if you're Catholic, go get your ashes tomorrow. That's really what it's all about. Not the boobies and beads of New Orleans, folks. We should do an entire Mardi Gras history episode sometime with somebody from the town of Mamou that my family is from. But anyway, welcome to the show tonight. I am very excited for our guests. This month has been kind of dedicated to two of my favorite topics tonight. But we've been doing a lot of remote viewing stuff this month because we not only have a remote viewing event coming up with Symposium of the Strange, but our good friend who is our guest tonight, Carl Anthony McClelland, from Vantage Point Remote Viewing, will be here in Austin. If you are in the Austin area and interested in remote viewing, wanting to learn remote viewing, this is an amazing opportunity for you to get some one-on-one training with Carl Anthony McClelland from Vantage Point Remote Viewing. Absolutely amazing stuff. We'll be talking with him in the second part of the episode about intuition and the idea of sharpening your intuition. He is a former special forces and private security individual, and talking with him about the idea of what it means to be able to trust your gut instinct when things happen and how that relates to remote viewing. In our first segment, a topic near and dear to my heart and one of the true causes of Curious Realm, targeted individuals is our topic in the first segment. And this is the first time that we have ever done this. A couple of times we have played segments from targeted individuals who have left us messages on our experiencer line, telling us about what it's like to be a targeted individual, what they experience. And we've given them advice with our good friend, Dr. John Hall. But tonight is our first real experiencer episode with targeted individuals. Our guest is Jason Stone. He has written a few articles that you can find over on the Cooper Point Journal. What could life be like connected with an AI chatterbot? And Jason Stone is our guest. Welcome to the show, Jason. How are you doing today?
Hey, Chris, I'm doing well. Thanks for inviting me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I am very enthused to have you on tonight because this is once again a topic that is near and dear to my heart. I have helped quite a few targeted individuals with binaural beat tracks, things like that. But to talk with a targeted individual is a unique situation. I speak to experiencers regularly of the paranormal, of UFO UAP contact, Jason. But when it comes to a TI, there is something different there to the experience that goes on with them, and something that is beyond the imagination of most people. And when you start digging into the actual affect long-term of life, of quality of life, it sadly goes to very sad places with a lot of TIs. So as I told you pre-show, I thank you for your courage, not only coming forth in the way that you've been writing articles about this technology and what it's like to be a TI, but also in coming on the show tonight. So thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, of course, Chris. My experience being a TI, I want to share information as the best that I can. And my experience varies. Sometimes it's easier to talk than others. And then at other times, just my life is pretty unmanageable. So right now is a good time to talk about it.
Well, I'm glad that you are on the mend with things, because yes, it is something that for most TIs comes and goes and at unpredictable times. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the topic, folks, really one of the easiest ways to modern day explain targeted individual is in the world of Havana syndrome and those that have been found to suffer from Havana syndrome, from what we now know as the immaculate concussion, being targeted via electronic means, things like that. Also things like gang stalking, organized gang stalking, invasion, private home invasion, all kinds of things, voice to skull technologies. It is a panoply of symptomology that goes on that really affects daily life to the point of many not being able to hold a job, many not being able to keep a relationship, all kinds of things. So, when did your TI experience begin with you, Jason? How long have you been what you would consider to be a TI?
I guess there's two ways to go at it. There's when I became like concretely aware that something was going on that I could not comprehend. And that was in the fall of 2018. However, prior to that, for about a year, I was going through peculiar experiences, things that I couldn't explain. Like having the sensation of like experiencing an earthquake and nothing was moving, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And once again, a lot of that symptomology, especially, comes about from things like microwave weaponry, high order RF fields, stuff like that. As somebody who worked broadcast, it was always a giddy little thrill. People don't realize that around the broadcast antennas at radio stations and broadcast dishes at TV stations, there's normally large wire to keep you out, like large barbed wire fences and things like that. Because if you get close enough, yeah, like you will feel that resonate and vibrate through your body. You know, like we literally invented microwave popcorn because somebody brought an ear of corn too close to a radar dish. You know, so the idea of your body feeling this, and like you were saying, almost in a sleep paralysis kind of way, where you were aware of what's going on, but not able to move or do anything about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There were several times where I would have something, which what I would describe as like a lucid dream. And it was basically like the same dream happening over a period of like several nights, sometimes separated by a few days. But basically I'd have these lucid dreams and then I would wake up and I could not move. I couldn't move or do anything. You know, I couldn't lift my hand. I couldn't, and I could barely even think. It was just, wow. It was really strange. And, so yeah, that happened quite a few times and I couldn't quite describe it. And eventually I started to figure things out.
Interesting. Now, let's backtrack with the question here real quick, Jason, because one of the big questions that I get from people whenever I talk about this regularly is why, you know, when we're talking Havana syndrome and the idea of, you know, embassy workers, things like that being targeted. That's one thing, but the average person, a lot of people are like, why, you know, is it the fact that have you ever served in the military, had any kind of classified background, anything like that, Jason?
No, I haven't actually. Relatives, yes, but
okay.
And yeah, definitely.
And that's because, yeah, your grandfather did serve in the Navy, correct?
That's right. That's right. And actually, both of them did in one capacity or another. Why is it happening to people? If you think about the way any sort of a test is run, it's you collect samples from a variety of demographics. So you get different people with different characteristics, from different economic levels, different belief systems, on and on and on. And you test out basically the same thing over and over and over on different people to see how it works and to train an AI system, which is controlling all of this. That's basically why it's happening. Sometimes there are people who do specific things, which basically like whistleblowing activity or something along those lines, and they might get drawn into it. But outside of that, it's basically a person just being themselves and fitting a like a demographic.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is a really great way to put it. That is how Dr. John Hall and I speak of it regularly, you know, and even the idea of is it like a government agency doing it? Likely not. But it's probably contractors thereof who have the technology and are testing it, you know, in a random sample kind of way.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. And it's a lot bigger than just in the United States. This is a global thing. And so there are different groups have different access to this technology.
Yeah.
And so there's that part to it as well. I mean, it's happening everywhere. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It is not just a United States phenomenon. There have been, and understand this, everybody, there have been claims of targeted individuals for at least the last 20 years that I know of, if not the last 30. I know the work of, Dr. Robert Duncan goes back at least 25 years, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. He's a early 2000s, but I mean, I believe from what I understand about his story, I believe he's working in this in like at least the 1990s and maybe even prior to that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And
it's interesting, you know, that you bring up the world of AI with this, Jason, because that was honestly a lot of the work of Dr. Duncan. Whenever he was, you know, getting his funding and things like that was the world of AI. So the idea that, and that is always why he said that he went whistleblower was the fact that he found out what they were actively using his technology for. And he was like, I'm out of here. I'm done. You know, we just lost Dr. Duncan this last year. Sadly, he was an amazing individual, a very good friend. And a really, really tip of the spear, when it came to a lot of this whistleblowing and talking about these programs. So you've written a couple of articles as I popped up on screen earlier. One of them, what could life be like connected with an AI chatterbot? So let's start getting into and exploring this idea of artificial intelligence being connected with specifically the voice-to-skull technology and the interior self-talk dialogue script that goes on with TIs, Jason.
Sure, sure.
So, go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, no. I was just about to ask you, like, how does AI lead into the world of TIs? How is it related to the technology used to basically hijack people's inner dialogues?
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. So if this isn't already known to most people, human beings are hackable, right? We emit electrical signals. They can be picked up. They can be analyzed. And they can be understood. And so basically AI helps to organize, sort, and connect all of the different data points. All like EEG sensory information, which is collecting information about like how the brain functions, fMRI, magnetic resonance imaging, another way to look at how the brain functions. And I mean, it goes on and on. There's way more advanced technology than that. That's something that I have like a basic familiarity with. And so basically, I think most people have experienced ChatGPT by now. And basically, a chatbot is collecting all of this information. It's being input into a system, which is creating like a large language model of the human being, and that's helping an AI chatbot to connect and speak with a person wirelessly. And it also can adapt to different protocols, different scripts, different schedules. Like, let's say there was a simulation of the world and Jason was in that simulation. If I was in that simulation, a digital double representing me, well, they could use that simulation to model out trajectories for my life, model out even just simple basic conversations or interrogation type activity. And the AI bot would play the role of the interrogator or the chat partner. And so that's sort of the way I look at how AI is used. And AI, it's sort of, it can adjust to the conversation or direct person in a certain direction just by talking about certain topics. It can sort of lead a person on to start thinking about things a certain way. Their subtle emotional and mental states can be adjusted to go along with the conversation.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it, once again, if you're used to using a chatbot, I'm a big ChatGPT user, things like that, you can have it write in specific tone, things like that. And it is amazing, especially whenever you start looking at AI in use for deepfake and that kind of stuff, Jason. It has gotten pretty indistinguishable over, and I would say over the last decade, because I know at least 2010, 2011 was the first time that I started seeing real AI being used in video creation, stuff like that, as well as audio creation. Things like RX coming out in the world of audio, where it was using AI to analyze background noise and cancel it out in music and in spoken word tracks, things like that. So to see where AI is leveraged to now, just in the common day, I mean, most people wouldn't realize, honestly, Jason, how much AI is involved in their daily life.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially like social media is a prime example of that. So I think most people are familiar with some of like the big social media platforms and basically the studies they run on people trying to see how they can be influenced by controlling their feed, their social media feed, right?
Yeah.
And so that's just basically a basic example.
Yeah, no, a real basic example, especially to show the idea of being able to read your mind, is straight up algorithmic programming for advertisement. And the idea of just by scanning the cookies on your phone, they can actively predict how regularly you're going to look for an item or look for something of interest for you. And I remember I work a lot in the world of corporate AV, things like that, Jason, and work a lot of Intel, AI conferences, things like that. And one of the things I remember the head of the FBI cyber crimes department saying at a white hat hacking convention here in Austin, and this was 2011. He said 5 years ago, this was 2011. So this would have been like 2006. At this point, we barely had BlackBerries, you know, we had flip phones at the time he was talking about. And he was like, 5 years ago, we were able to algorithmically predict where you would be 5 minutes from now with a 90% accuracy rate.
That's
kind of disturbing to know that just from cell phone data, things like that, that they could algorithmically predict where you were going to be. So the idea of gang stalking, let's say, is now taken to a whole new level when you start looking at those things, when you start considering the way that cell phones ping off stuff, ping off location, ping off stores that you're going by, everything else. It would not be rocket math for somebody to be able to get your phone number, pop it into a program, and literally follow you around town on the daily, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And as far as AI goes, I'm going to play something here real quick, because once again, Chris plays with AI, everybody. And to the point, this will tell you, everybody, the point and the accuracy to which the AI is out there. I have programmed an AI in my voice. It took 20 minutes of me talking, 20 minutes of audio. I literally snipped up 20 minutes of things like this from an interview and fed it to an AI. And I now have an AI of my voice, Jason, for a mere $5 a month. Not even joking. And I'm about to play it and you'll hear its accuracy. And imagine if somebody was to take 20 minutes of you talking. There's all kinds of cell phone signals that can be dropped. Okay, as we know from Edward Snowden, they're listening to every single one of them. You know, mm-hmm. We know that Zoom audio is recording every single conversation for AI, whether or not you hit record or not. So if you've been in a therapy conversation with your therapist via Zoom over the last year and a half, folks, your conversation was recorded and put in their servers to train an AI, whether your therapist hit record or not, just an FYI. But here is a quick sample of how accurate AI can be. This is me, my voice, an AI, reading a script about the holographic universe. Considered that reality,
my voice,
everything
AI,
you know, everything you feel, everything universe might not be what it seems. That the solidity of the ground beneath your feet,
considered that
the
reality,
vastness of the sky. So, sorry, we're getting a little bit of doubling back there, folks. But you can hear how accurate that is to my voice.
The vast,
not a hologram
the
like the kind you so, see on a credit card sorry, or in a sci-fi. So the fact that with just a mere 20 minutes of my conversation, an AI can pick up the influx or the inflection of my voice, the meter of my voice, the timbre of my voice, that is pretty remarkable. And from there, it's tunable. I can make myself more excited, more sad, more somber, all kinds of things. So when you're talking voice-to-skull technology, when you're talking somebody using your own voice to hijack your thoughts, fully possible, Jason.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you know this probably, I'm sure you know this, that military technology, intelligence technologies, they are probably like 20 or 30 years ahead yep. of what's commercially available all the time, pretty much.
Oh, absolutely.
So what they're able to do right now is like way beyond anything we could probably imagine, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you know, even the idea that until Havana Syndrome, Jason, we were told by our government that sonic weapons do not exist. Like, yeah, we have some sonic crowd control, things like that, you know, but sonic weaponry like that doesn't exist. Till we started seeing articles from Popular Mechanics, like, so what is the secretive Chinese sonic weapon? You know, that was literally a weapon that could be shoulder fired, that could vibrate your brain inside your skull, you know, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, I think to me, that event, the Havana Syndrome events, kind of was a way to announce something and then to deny it at the same time, right?
Yes.
Like that's
sort
of like the route it took, like, this is mass hysteria or something along those lines. But then at the same time, there are other people saying that, well, if this were occurring, it's probably due to some sort of an exotic weaponry, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And it very much like the last UFO hearing that happened, where they're like, well, UFO retrieval programs don't exist, right? Yes, correct. Well, what about this gentleman who's receiving benefits from the federal government for being injured in a UFO crash retrieval?
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's the way it goes. That's the way they play it, generally, it seems like.
Yeah.
You know?
And sadly, you know, as we say on the show regularly with Dr. John Hall, make no mistake, folk, there, and feel free to look it up. There is zero law on the books that prevents the federal government from being able to experiment on the populace. Zero law. There's zero law that there is now a Havana Syndrome Protection Act. That's a plus. However, there, you know, the really the only law that we have in existence about such things is the one because we know it works. Is the one about subliminal programming inside of movies and broadcasts. Like subliminals are no longer allowed, like where they used to flash like drink Coke during Let's Go Out to the Lobby and stuff like that in one frame of a 1 minute of a movie. You know, that kind of stuff. And we have that law in place because we know subliminal advertising works. You know, like we know that our brains will receive these messages in this kind of way. So we have laws against it, but it's fascinating to know that there is no law that prevents the government from experimenting on the populace in a mass way. And feel free to look that up, folks. There isn't.
Well,
go ahead.
That sort of reminds me, you know, going back to the MK Ultra days.
Yep.
One way that they sort of went about it was, well, if we do the experiments on ourselves, so if we do the LSD tests on ourselves or try some of these experiments on the researchers, then we know that we can do it on the people, on the test subjects, right? And there's something about being able to do research which might allow them to skirt some of the laws that would prevent some of these activities from happening.
Oh, absolutely.
And we already know that they're not actually really interested in following laws in any case. So,
well, and that's something that, once again, we say regularly on the show is feel free to, I will wait. Like, I'll sit here and watch my imaginary watch on my wrist, everybody. But I will wait while you try to tell me the time that any alphabet agency has been called to task before the House or Senate and has told the truth the first time around. You know, there's typically some sort of deception. There's typically some sort of issue that goes on. And then they're called to task later and they have to be like, yeah, okay, you're right. We did that. And I just had up on screen a second ago the Pont Saint-Esprit poisoning that the CIA was involved in. And there were numerous cases of towns, things like that. They definitely used prisoners during the MK Ultra experiments. And all that came out during the church hearings that there was not only... there was Operation Monarch before MK Ultra. There were programs before MK Ultra. There have been programs after it. You know,
absolutely, yeah, and, yeah. I mean, Charles Manson, he is one of the prisoners that was tested in the MK Ultra experiments.
Yeah, same thing with Whitey Bulger.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly.
Like Whitey Bulger, I think, had like 25 LSD sessions in the MK Ultra documents, something like that. Like an insane number of a very high intensity LSD. It wasn't like, oh, here's like a tiny little drop. It's like, here's like five or six drops of LSD. That's a sincere trip, y'all. That taking 25, 30 times en masse like that can possibly do a little damage to your brain. And once again, to see the fact that we funded that. We funded experiments. I'm trying to remember the name. It didn't come out in the church committee, but it was the one that the movie Jacob's Ladder was based on, where they were basically working on. What's that?
Oh, yeah. In the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Vietnam War.
Yeah. Where they were basically working on like a gaseous form of LSD to incapacitate troops. And all those guys suffered for years afterward, still suffering. You know, from after effects. And you may say like, yeah, well, you know, they were all military members. There's a lot out there. It's frightening, Jason, once you start digging into it. And it doesn't take like a shovel and spade worth of digging. It's like a light trowel scraping, like an archaeologist to find these things. You know, they are not hidden extraordinarily deep in the history or annals of our country, you know?
Yeah, no, you'll hear about these stories in the news pretty much every single day. There are major events that happen quite regularly. And if you sort of dig into it a little bit, you'll see these patterns or these traits where people are having pretty peculiar experiences. They're basically TIs. They aren't aware of it, so they act out in certain ways that end up doing a lot of harm to themselves and people around them, which is sort of that CIA memo about having people act in ways which are not to, what is it? The aim is controlling an individual to the point where he will do our bidding against his will and even against such fundamental laws of nature as self-preservation.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right. And it's interesting because Sirhan Sirhan is a prime example of that idea where he remembers a woman in a polka dot dress and after that being slammed to the ground with a gun in his hand. He does not remember the actual shooting of Robert Kennedy. He remembers none of that. And when Bobby's son went and talked to him in prison, he came out and was like, I believe Sirhan Sirhan. Like I believe his story full on. And it's interesting to see those things. And let's start getting into, your symptomology, Jason, and how you came to find out about being a targeted individual. What was it that first kind of cued you to the fact that something was amiss in your daily life?
Yeah, it was like I had a regular job and I was going to an office, you know, pretty much every single weekday. And it was pretty loud outside of my office.
Okay.
There was like two parts of the building and there was like this construction or workshop area and then an office space. And then from the office space, I was like hearing these conversations coming through the air vents in my office. And at first, I didn't really notice it. I just thought, well, you know, I'm just hearing the guys talking about whatever they talk about every single day. But then, like, something changed, and the conversations started to, like, slowly and slowly get more oriented towards information about myself or information about things that, like, I had only thought about but had never spoken. And that really disturbed me, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that began to happen. And then I started to notice it like going to certain places where it was like, it would sound like hearing a conversation going, talking around a corner or things like that, you know? And, so that's, I guess I would say that's when I started to kind of notice like, hey, something strange is going on here. And I couldn't quite figure it out. It took a little while, and then I actually talked to a friend and just sort of shared my experience. And they're like, oh, yeah, I think there's something else going on. And then they sort of outlined the whole phenomena or experience of TIs.
Okay.
That's when it clicked.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, once again, that idea of unfamiliar conversation in your head. And it's something that Dr. John Hall and I speak about regularly is the idea of know your inner voice, know who you are, you know, like intrinsically as a person. And always remember that because, the voices that do come from voice to skull, things like that are frequently, even though it's your own voice and seems like inner dialogue, are very counterintuitive as to who you are, you know, and for what you stand for and for what you believe as a person. And like you were saying, that was part of the protocols of MK Ultra was to get somebody to abandon such things to do what you want them to do. So what does it take to quote psychologically break somebody to the point of bending their will to yours or having them carry out actions, so to speak. And knowing your inner dialogue, I think is hugely important to, counteracting that, Jason.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, knowledge is power, right?
Yeah.
Like if the truth will set you free, then the opposite will enslave you basically is the way I look at it, you know? So it's important to just like sometimes slow down. And I think journaling helps out quite a bit.
Okay.
Recording your experiences, writing down what you think, you know, just in whatever strategy you want to take, whether you want to write the journal as like some notes for a book or whatnot, whatever.
Sure.
Whatever strategy a person might want to use, it can help to sort of like track certain things happening in your life, because this program is meant to do that. It's meant to destabilize a person and to replace them, basically. And sort of that's the way I look at it, where there can come a point where all of the electrical signals coming from a person can be captured and retransmitted back and altered. And it doesn't even have to be from the same person. They can be from one person and then adjusted and sent to person B, you know? And so being able to journal, keep track of those things, and have an awareness of that, it's important. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the journaling, I think, like you're saying, is hugely important, because that is going to give you and anybody else, be it family, therapist, what have you, a very good indicator of what's going on, you know, and give you a good timeline. Now, and granted, you know, many of the TIs that I have talked to and worked with Jason have been to therapists, and there have been a few therapists that have worked very well with them. Many of them do not ascribe to the concept of TI or to the experience of a TI. And I find that very saddening, you know, much like we talk about on the show regularly. It's not every therapist who is going to react well if you say, last Tuesday, I had a beam of light come through my room and I was teleported through the wall into a craft, you know, with beings from another planet. There aren't a lot of therapists that will react well to that either, you know.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean that the experience didn't happen, and it doesn't mean that the experience, at least within the mind of the person, did not happen, which can still cause trauma and still cause issues, you know. And even when you're talking TI and the world of TI, it's interesting to see some of the response within the communities about it. One of the things that I've done whenever I go out and scan properties for TIs, for radio signals, things like that, is pull out other equipment first. And I've always noticed that the family is very relieved with that fact, that like, I'm not just immediately going to the radio signals, you know, let's see if we can get rid of any other anomalies, stuff like that. And one of the things I ask regularly is like, how often have you, or not how often, but how long have you occupied this space, this home? You know, and because is this a symptomology that followed you from your last location to here? Is this something that started when you moved here or just began here? Things like that. So that would be a question I'd ask you at this point, Jason, is this something that has followed you? How long has it followed you?
I think that in its current iteration, yeah, it's continued from place to place.
Okay.
I'm not aware of any sort of barriers or counteractions or like a response, except for dealing with the body, detoxing from the sensitization materials, which generally is heavy metals.
Sure.
But it's also the other, basically it's described as biofilms. So getting a handle of your health is important. But basically, even the people who experience this and then it ends, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're done with that person. I mean, I've heard of people where they had these experiences for a time and then it stopped and then it started back up again at a later date. And so even the people where it's totally done or ended, they're probably still under observation for one reason or another, you know? So that's, I mean, at least that's my perspective on it.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, it's kind of the idea of, you know, once a phone line's tapped, it ain't hard to get back into it, you know? Same thing with a computer. Like once you've busted through that security wall, it's not going to be hard for you to get back in or for you to leave a back door on your way out, you know? So the idea of it ever, quote, being over all the way, is hard to imagine, Jason. And at the same time, understanding that there may be an alleviation of the symptomology for a while, sometimes even permanently, from what I know for a few people, that it's been years and years since they've been away from it or since they've had an incident of it. And numerous people that I know that whenever they go out to like no cell phone country, you know, to go deep woods camping, things like that, where they get no cell phone signal, that kind of stuff, that this symptomology is alleviated for them in a large way. And there is definitely a crowd of people out there that are very EM sensitive when it comes to electricity, electromagnetic fields, things like that. So the fact of somebody possibly having an allergy to an electromagnetic field or an RF frequency range, something like that, is not beyond comprehension, at least in my mind. So,
sure.
Now when it comes to, your symptomology, Jason, and do you find that, there are certain times when things are worse than others? Or is it fairly commonplace all the time, like tinnitus, where it's just kind of always in the background and you have to silence it out? How does that work for you?
I would say that my experience is something of like patterns which change slowly over time. And so I might have like a certain set of experiences where I, you know, have sensitivity to hearing, sensitivity to the cold, things along of that nature, and that'll last for a while, and then it'll change into something else, and maybe it's like difficulty seeing or something along those lines. And that's how I would describe it at times, but then it can change quickly, and I don't really have a way to determine why that happens. I think that it's just basically trying to build up a sort of a false sense of safety, basically.
Okay.
And then sort of disrupting the personality or the ability of a person to function.
Okay. And in what way does it disrupt your function? Is it like you were saying before, where is it always the fact that you feel the tremble through your body that you can't control? How does it interrupt daily?
It could be like having a sense of like exhaustion, or having a difficulty to focus. Those are two ways that I notice it specifically. Other times it's sort of difficult because, to tell like, okay, what's exactly going on? Is it because I haven't eaten today, or if I haven't gotten a good meal in?
Sure.
Or, you know, is this why I'm feeling the way I am? And sometimes that's often the reason, or maybe I'm not, taking my vitamins or something just like off the wall like that. But I think that, doing the best that I can to take care of myself in the most simplest of ways. It's a way to deal with it where I don't make it too complicated, and I try and stick to some basic things to take care of myself. That seems to help out. But I also know just from understanding about other people's experiences that it's not that way for everybody, and it can get worse. And I mean, it can get easier too.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, that, it, especially that idea of self-care, that is hugely important. That's something that, we were talking about that pre-show, and Dr. John Hall and I talk about that regularly, especially whenever we are confronted with TIs and how to help them is the important of the importance of self-care and doing things that you enjoy. And the more you can break that cycle of negativity and negative self-talk, those are things that just kind of amplify the signal of the technology, so to speak. You know, it really is. It's one of the ways that, as we were talking about earlier, that, you know, they're finding like that typology to target, you know. And if you've already got somebody who is living in their head that kind of way, with their inner voice all the time screaming at them, telling them bad things, things like that, it's not going to be hard to give it that extra nudge, you know, to go other places, Jason. And that's right. The horrible fact of it. So yeah, the more you can be active, the more you can spend time with family, the more you can play guitar, if you play guitar, what have you, those things tend to help mitigate quite a bit. If anything, taking your mind off the fact. And the more you do that, the more it can help. So even the fact of I have once again made numerous binaural beat tracks for people. And I'll make sure to share a copy of my album with you, Jason. But that's something that specifically, as Dr. John Hall says, with bone conducting headphones. You know, so that it's not hijacked by other things, or, you know, the wires being used as antenna, something like that. So he is a big proponent of the bone conducting headphones for that kind of stuff. And I tend to agree with him on that.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Something that I would consider is using non-wireless but wired bone conducting headphones. And then if you have like a CD player or MP3 player, not having it plugged into the wall while you're operating it, because that can be a problem.
And you know, there's all kinds of stuff out there now, like grounding blankets, for instance. Great fantastic idea. It's basically like sleeping under a Faraday cage. You know, so that can definitely help with some stuff. So there's some fantastic things out there now, to help mitigate RF in the home. Because otherwise, and this is what I've had to tell a lot of family members who've asked me about jamming systems and things like that, is, you know, there's sadly, Jason, a lot out there. When it comes to these things that are sadly snake oil, you know, and even one schematic that somebody sent me that was like, I saw this on somebody's website and I'm thinking about making it to put in my son's room. And I'm like, good God, that is like a massively high voltage Tesla coil. Why would you put that in your child's room? Like,
yeah, you have to be careful.
It was like that is some high order RF field that you're looking at putting there to like block the other RF field. But those are huge, massive capacitors that you're talking about that could like kill your kid if they touch them, you know.
So you have to be careful what you try. You mitigate, the help can't be worse than the harm.
Well, and that's just it. And sadly, there's numerous people out there that will gladly take advantage of those that are looking for help for such a thing, to the tunes of commas and zeros, you know. And I always hate seeing that. I always hate hearing that, because much like any experience or community, these are real things that happen to people. And it can lead to bad places in life when you do such things and things don't help. You know, So with that in mind, we've got you for about another 9-10 minutes, Jason. What has worked for you as far as mitigating these things in your life? How do you suggest other TIs go about returning some sort of ground and normalcy to their life?
Yeah, I would, something to keep in mind is that what you're experiencing is happening to other people. It's also happening to other people and they're not aware of it. They're not, it's not expressed in the same ways. So I just try to treat myself and treat other people with kindness and to take care of myself and take care of my health the best that I can. And the things that you mentioned earlier, like the blankets that I think it can't recall, like the RF blankets, those can help out. Some of these signals, from what I understand, they're of a type where it's not easily blocked. And you might know a little bit more about that than me, but that is one thing that does help. And in the binaural beats, using the setup that I described earlier with, non-wireless headphones, and then, whatever you're using, a CD player or MP3, something that's not plugged into the wall, resonating with the whole wireless system of wherever you're located.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And up on screen right now, I actually have a Faraday EMF protection canopy for your bed. That's like a mosquito net that's made out of copper mesh, that then goes to a ground. So, once again, all kinds of stuff out there, and to know that, these things can help. But what about families, Jason? Because that is, I think, probably the saddest part, is how these things drive families apart sometimes, with an experiencer not being listened to by family. How can families deal with this? How can they approach their TI family member with a different understanding?
I think something really important is information and education, like getting the right information and then educating yourself on what's happening. That way that you have some idea of what you're dealing with. And I mean, I think that's basically where it starts. There are so many different experiences and people in different places that it's sort of hard to give like a one size fits all solution.
Yeah.
But I think that if people are a little better informed about what's happening, then they might be able to have a different response. Because that's basically with anything in life, like whatever information you have is going to help determine your type of response. So if you have bad information or only half of the information on a topic, that's how well of a solution that you can devise. Generally speaking, you know, you might get lucky and figure out a way to deal with things with knowing just like, you know, a little bit, but that's not usually the way it works out, at least from my own experience.
Yeah.
So,
and if you could give one message to TIs out there tonight, Jason, what would it be?
It would be to hold on to some part of your humanity, to find something about yourself, maybe something that you did prior to these experiences, or maybe something that you learned about yourself and that you participate in some activity, hobby, something that you do in your community or with your family, to remain human and to at least distance yourself to a certain extent from electronics. It's sort of like a weird thing to say because there's so much a part of our life, but we're also human beings too. And this program, in a sense, is trying to mechanize or computerize or gamify, you know, your life, and, you know, run your life through a supercomputer. And so I would basically just say, try to remain human if you can.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Keeping, once again, keeping that proper sense of humanity in your mind and keeping a good control of who you are. You know, that grounding sense of this is who I am, this is what I believe. But once again, the more you have that, the harder it is for that algorithm to be able to lock in and do what it's designed to do. Thank you so much for your time tonight, Jason. It has been more than revealing talking with you. Thank you so much for your courage, not only coming on the show, but on the daily to face this, because it's not easy. It's not easy, especially to let the new world know that it's happening and that it's out there. So thank you for that. I greatly appreciate it. Where can everybody go to follow your work? Because you're out there once again on a few shows like this talking about things, but you're also out there writing about this. Where can people go to follow your writing, everything else, Jason?
So right now I don't have a huge online presence, but I'm working on a book that I'm going to put out in the fall of this year.
Great.
It's called Theater of Shadows, and it's basically like a meta-analysis of TI experiences. So this is like a collection or a case study of the different types of experiences to try and create a picture or idea of what's happening. And that'll be out in the fall.
Fantastic. Well, we definitely want to have you back on whenever that comes out, not only to help get word out and to help promote it, but to really dig into those cases and similarities between them, things like that. So thank you so much for your time tonight, Jason. Greatly appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Chris. I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. Take care, and we will be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff very soon.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Take care. Man, such a revealing conversation. Thank you so much, Jason, for coming on. And once again, thank you for your strength with dealing with this. And I say that to any experiencer out there, because it's not easy. It's not easy even to come to terms in your own mind that something is happening to you or has happened to you, much less letting the world know that something has happened. It can be, as the term goes, that point of shock, the ontologic shock that just changes the way that your entire world operates and the way that you operate in it. So thank you so much, Jason, for your time tonight again. And God bless all of you TIs out there. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight. We'll be coming back right after this quick commercial break. We will be joined by our good friend Carl Anthony McClellan of Vantage Point Remote Viewing. We will be talking about the world of remote viewing, as well as the idea of intuition and where intuition comes from, what that's all about, and how to sharpen your intuition and what that has to do with remote viewing. So we will be getting into that with our good friend Carl Anthony McClellan right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying with us. And also, of course, thank you to our sponsors, True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like I am, True Hemp Science is an absolutely amazing product. I have been using them for years. And when I was recommended CBD by my doctor for my travel anxiety, I began my search nationwide as I went to cities that had dispensaries, things like that, to find the best CBD that I could. And little did I know, it was right here in my backyard in Austin, Texas. Christopher Lynch develops an amazing product using a spigeric process, using every part of the plant, seeds, stems, buds, leaves, roots. Every part is used, reused, then combusted and reused until nothing remains, providing an amazing full-spectrum CBD product, complete with terpene profiles and everything else. Stop on by and check them out. True Hemp Science is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your cart of $50 or more, folks. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. While you are on the internet, stop on by the website of our guest in this segment, Vantage Point RV. We are talking remote viewing in this segment tonight. We're kind of spending a month on the topic. It's a topic that is near and dear to my heart, because it brings so many things together in the world. And the beginning of our conversation tonight with our guest, Carl Anthony McClellan from Vantage Point Remote Viewing, will be about intuition. He spent years as a private security contractor, and that is really, I think, a great primer for people to understand what a lot of remote viewing is. Carl, welcome back to the show. By the way.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be back.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't want to dwell too long on the world of personal security and private security because, I mean, of course, there's a lot of things that you cannot talk about. You were in the world of private security. But the idea of honing that sense of intuition, honing that sense of walking in somewhere and knowing that something is off or amiss, is hugely important in the world of private security contracting, in the world of military, things like that. How did you first come to the world of military service and private security contracting, Carl?
Well, I left school, obviously. 10 days after, I was down the south of England in the British Army training. Did a few years in the military, left. But of course, when you're serving different countries and meeting different regiments and different military from abroad, you know, American, different European militaries, you get friends, you get contacts. And when I came out, you sort of get in a network. And then, oh, there's a job going here. Would you fancy it? And it sort of stems from there.
Sure.
Going on the point of any foresight or sixth sense, it really is a gut feeling. You sort of feel the situation. It's like they say, you know, read the room, read the layout, and you just get sort of owned on a skill set basis of maybe what's going on, something not looking right. It's like a cop's intuition. I remember my father used to tell me, he was a police officer in England, You do get a sixth sense that something's not looking right. You know, it's a very hot day and this guy's walking around with a big, long, thick jacket on. Why is this? You know, the car's passed three times circling round, that sort of thing. That guy's not really window shopping. He's looking at the reflection across the road because he keeps turning around to double check. And it's that sort of thing. It's what everybody does with various things in life, but ironically, a lot don't know they're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. And one of the main reasons why I wanted to bring that up as we got into this topic tonight, because the idea of sharpening your intuition, the idea of being fully present in a moment, you know, is really fascinating and something that is hugely important to a remote viewer. You know, there's even a process at the beginning of remote viewing to get rid of your distracted thoughts. You know, that moment of check-in to begin with, like what might interrupt my session? What might filter my session in a different way? You know, and very much even doing the same thing. It's one of those you can't really think about home, stuff like that while you're in that moment in a secure, like you have to be fully present. You have to be right there and in that moment to receive any of that. Yeah, the typical person may brush off as like, oh, you know, that's paranoia or, you know, something like that. Whereas a security professional uses that to their advantage.
Absolutely. It's funny you should say paranoia because I always have a thing where I'll say I have a healthy paranoia. I will have this slight paranoia where I will take a closer look at things. And as you say, with remote viewing, it's exactly the same. You know, you're quietening down the noise or whatever term you want to use, and you're literally trying to shut everything out and focus and get your intuitiveness, connecting.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. Yeah. And the idea of being connected to that root, being connected to that vibration and knowing when a chord has been struck, knowing when something is amiss, when something is awry, that's very much the same as the unfiltered processing that is required for remote viewing. The idea, because I think a lot of people have a mistaken concept, Carl, when it comes to remote viewing, and the idea that you have to get into a fully meditative mindset, you know, or something like that. When I've found it, at least for me, quite the opposite. It's almost the opposite of, you have to get yourself prepared, definitely. But it's not like the same as when I practiced meditation or ecstatic prayer, where I am trying to like silence the world out and hyper focus on a point of silence. It's different than that.
It, absolutely, Chris. You know, when I first started, and it's like brand new, and you're learning all your things. And I used to sort of take a minute and just dial down, literally shut the noise. But now, sometimes I've done remote viewing sessions, very quick ones, on my way out to work. I've literally seen a colleague of mine post something. My husband's hidden some chocolates because I'm on a diet for a bit of fun when anybody remote view. And I sort of looked at it. I'm going out the door and thought, nah, I want to stab at this. And I've literally just sat down, gone in the zone very quickly, scratched a few things down and emailed it to them. And they've got back and said, wow, I found them in 2 minutes flat with your session. Wow. So it can be that responsive. Yeah. But it's the same as anything, as you mentioned. It's getting the proper training. That is a must, obviously, as you well know yourself. And it's practice. Keep practicing. Put the time and effort in. It pays dividends.
Yeah, yeah. And with that being said, let's kind of start cracking the nut of remote viewing and that practice. And especially, how did you – because I'm not going to say that the two are separated by a chasm, the world of private security and intelligentsia and remote viewing. They are not. Remote viewing came from the world of intelligentsia. But how was it ever the case that how did you become exposed to the world of remote viewing, Carl? Did you know about it before you went in to intelligentsia and security?
No.
Or did you find out about it through that world?
I'd never heard of it until about 5.5, 6 years ago. Never heard the term. on the psychic intuitive type, going back to my grandparents, they used to, they were professionals. My grandfather in the war used to send the secret messages to the agents behind enemy lines in France.
Oh, wow.
My nan worked at a munitions factory. But in the spare time, did read palms and tea leaves. Huh. My father was a police officer. My mum was a nurse, but they was heavily into spiritual healing. So it was something I'd sort of seen all throughout growing up. But the term remote viewing, no. I'm not sure whether we discussed this on the other conference cruise or no, I actually got into it. I can't remember that, Chris, did we?
I can't recall either. So let's get into that.
Just in case any of your viewers did watch that one and I did mention that, I was doing some meditation when I was training to be a medium.
Okay.
What we call an evidential medium in the UK, where you're giving facts, you know, it's your great grandmother and she looked like this and she left you a set of beads and you keep them in your top drawer, that type of thing. And I got into meditation and I saw a guy who's alive and well on the earth plane, and he was going into a house. So I'm thinking, wow, this is like really weird. So I followed him in and generally did a couple of sketches, wrote down different things, being observant. And then after that, I actually pulled the guy and his wife and I said, look, I hope you don't mind, but I feel really awful invading your privacy. Is this where you live? And they said, no, we live in a bungalow. However, we used to live there 10 years ago. So this blew my mind. And then straight away, took a few attempts on Google, getting the specifics of what had happened. And then I found the term remote viewing. It went on from there.
Wow. Wow. And you know, the idea of mediumship, and I think... I think there's definitely a line of difference between mediumship, clairvoyance, and remote viewing, at least the discipline of remote viewing. Now, granted, and hilariously, Carl, and I'm not going to say hilariously, more sadly, when I posted that I was part of Psygames last week, the same time that I put the ad out for your upcoming event here in Austin, shameless plug moment. There was quite a recoil from the religious right, let's just say, that belong in my group. And quite a few people went down a lot of dark roads, Christianity wise, when it comes to remote viewing. And I was like, whoa, hold on. This is different, you know, and nobody is going like practicing, you know, spiritualism here. Nobody is going down those roads. Nobody is talking necromancy or anything like that, or I would even say any kind of sorcery was brought up. And I understand that, you know, but once again, it's not like you are necessarily astral projecting in that kind of way, is what I would say. And all of these things are definitely related to the world of remote viewing. Don't get me wrong, from astral projection to mediumship, to clairvoyance, they all touchstones within the world of remote viewing. However, I akin remote viewing much more to the fact of your radio in your car picks up all kinds of frequencies. However, it's locked into specific frequencies, you know? You can't really sideband a lot of things on there, but if you had an analog radio, you could get in between all kinds of frequencies and find things. And hey, on a good stormy night in Houston, one of my favorite things was my old analog AM radio from the 70s, because I could actively pick up AM radio from Dallas on a good stormy night when the ionosphere was right, you know? So that's what I akin remote viewing to, the fact of we are always receiving these frequencies. We're always receiving these things. The question is whether or not we are processing them in that kind of way.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, in the processing them in that kind of way, there's a saying what I totally agree with, whether it's mediumship or remote viewing or anything else of the intuitive skills. And it's saying the information is never wrong what you receive. It's how we interpret the information. Yeah. And this is where we go wrong as remote viewers or whatever else. And actually, it's just brought me to a point of looking back on the Irva cruise last year, what we was on.
Yeah.
The funny comment you had been stitches with on the Irva cruise last October, where you say, y'all mind hanging back, you're jamming my frequencies.
Yeah.
Oh, obviously a brilliant classic line. And it's so true, because I liken it to that. And the way we're teaching it with Vantage Point is, do you know what? Tune in like an old radio, and then get what you need to get with your impressions and your data and everything else. And then don't be frightened of running across a little bit and tune into another and get more information. And it's just dialing in to different intuitive things. Because at the end of the day, for my point of view, is it doesn't matter what you do, use every intuitive skill you have in your toolbox.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you're going to collate a lot more information that way. So it definitely is a type of dialing in, Chris.
Well, and especially when it comes to remote viewing, there is we had a great conversation last time we had you on regarding the fact that it's very personal. The art of remote viewing and the science of remote viewing. It's the fact that, even though I'm trained in controlled remote viewing, from Lynn Buchanan, things like that, there are a lot of the protocols that I have to go through at the beginning of a session that are very, very trip up for me. And kind of, I think at least not necessarily create a barrier, but almost a speed bump to me getting to the process, you know?
It can be. I mean, every methodology in remote viewing from, you know, control remote viewing to ours, which is like a type of free form or free flow, they're all good and they all work. What I decided to try with Vantage Point was the fact that we all learn differently. Regardless of intelligence or education, we all sort of pick up things in a different and unique manner. Mm. So one or two people in a class may be, oh, they like it that way, and it's strict protocol and it's set six stages. And others, because we're all unique, may want it put in a different way. So what Vantage Point offers is, an, if you like, it's a buffet of intuitive tools for you to actually try them all, select the ones what work best for you, and you make it bespoke to you, your character, the way you really feel comfortable and natural doing it. And I'm a firm believer, if you can teach anyone a way that is fitting to them personally, or they maybe get to choose, right, then they will be better at it. It's like you and I going on the buffet breakfast on the ship, as we did, and having bacon every morning. Maybe we want sausage, maybe we want a cereal, a bit of salad, you know, and then we'll, oh, I like this, I don't like that. And that's what it is, and that's why it's unique in that way that, this protocols, you know, setting your sheet up, and it's done professionally, of course. But the tools we offer, and to say, look, give this a try, then give this a try, then do it this way, it is a way that the student's going to turn around and think, maybe three or four like this way, and maybe another two like that way. But as long as we all get the same results at the end, mission accomplished.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's just it. It really does come down to the point of the data that's being processed at the end of a session, you know.
Exactly.
And if it took you partially using ARV during part of your session to do that, okay, that's fine, you know. And it's interesting that you do really conglomerate all of these styles together with the way that you're teaching things, Carl?
Yeah, I mean, it does work really well, because it's like, for instance, when I started off remote viewing, a lot of my things come in metaphorically. And I'll give you an example. On a session I did a few months ago, the first impression I got was of a Venus flytrap. So I sketched it down, sort of biological. It looked like a Venus flytrap. But all as I was sensing there was death. Now that's one of my symbols for death. And it turned out, with the rest of the story, what was pieced together, when I did the summary, it was about the nuclear reactor after the tsunami and underwater earthquake, obviously, in Japan. Do you remember that a few years ago?
Fukushima.
And they tried to cover it up. So I had all these different things of building, very hush-hush, lots of people getting killed. But the initial one, which was likened to a Venus flytrap, had nothing to do with it if it was under very strict protocols. It would be AOL'd, analytical overlaid. But that showed me that death was, you know, 99% imminent. I've had another where I'll get things, say, an umbrella-type canopy or parasol. It has nothing probably to do with the actual photo feedback or video. But for me, it shows every time it's protection. There's something being protected. So there is different ways, shapes and forms it can come in. And what Vantage Point have done is look at that from the, not only the teacher's perspective, but the students, and say, yes, we get what AOLs are. Absolutely. However, what if that is the way that they personally or naturally or both interpret? I've proved it many times, they could have an absolutely brilliant session correlating to the feedback and everything else just because of that. The one with the umbrella and the parasol, the photo feedback was some animals protecting a vulnerable animal until they could rebuild the lure, shelter, home, right? Now, normally they say, well, there's a parasol. That's not in the picture. But it was my way of saying it's protection. Like you protect a kid, you throw your arms around it, and you make sure you come to no harm. And that's what the animals were doing with like the queen, if you like, the leader of the pack. So that got me onto the rest of the story where it was showing vulnerability, protection and everything else.
Yeah.
So we personally don't just write them off. You know, look at how a student may interpret the data coming through. And I find sometimes it's overlooked. It's not for everybody, but the way we do it gives everybody a set of tools. They can take every tool with them, but they don't have to use them all. They can pick which tools they will implement in a session on how best they interpret the data.
Well, and let's explore the idea of an analytic overlay real quick, Carl, because some of the audience may not be too familiar with the world of remote viewing. They may be familiar with the concept, but that is that's a pretty deep concept in the world of remote viewing, the idea that that you're basically looking at something through a pre-existing filter or through a filter of some sort. So let's explore that idea and how it's typically seen by remote viewing and how you and the way that you train things treat it a little bit differently.
Yeah, well, as you know yourself, Chris, with being a remote viewer, an analytical overlay, AOL, is when your left brain kicks in and it names it. It's jumping about. That's what your brain does. It's like a computer and it's going, oh, hang on. Oh, it's an apple.
Yeah.
And you've named it. It's a noun, end of. And then, of course, you declare it and you move on, right? Yeah. But there's a lot more to it, as you well know. Well, what Vantage Point saying the training, to make it simple, because so many people get confused with AOLs and what they are. And we say, look, if you name it, naming it equals known equals AOL. If it repeats, then give it consideration. Bring it in, ask a few questions, go from there.
Okay.
Because it's a concept. What I know many students have found, I wouldn't say frightening, but off-putting. Oh, it's an AOL and my brain's jumped in and named it. And absolutely, you don't want to be saying "certle" for a circular shape. You want to be saying curved or arched or arced or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's just fine tuning. But I do believe simplicity in anything is key, not overwhelming. And by bringing it down to these simple things, I believe it's digested a lot easier.
It is a big topic. It's a hard topic. And when you begin training, especially in various forms, you know, there's a lot of terminology that you have to learn, Carl. And there's wow. What seems to be a mountain that is in the way of the doorway. You know, I know a lot of people. I have tried no less than three times in life to at least begin some kind of remote viewing journey, whether it was watching a video online, what have you. And it was the kindness of Lynn Buchanan and him granting me access to his program and me watching them, and his very, very good patient breaking down in very small snippets what these concepts are and what a gestalt is. Things like that, and how to begin a session, you know. But there's a lot that I think can once again discourage the average person from taking a remote viewing course. At least as far as traditional training
and overwhelming
goes.
to newbies, absolutely. And you know, there's some good courses. But what I've done is perceive it from being brand new, sitting down and saying, right, I don't even know what remote viewing is. I want to take this course. I know it's going to come across to me. Now, I'm a pretty intelligent lad. I'm no Einstein. But, you know, I do grasp things and I've had an education. But I don't think it's actually down to that. And this is the point I'm making. It's against, without sounding repetitive, how we perceive things. If I look and it's a load of technical jargon and it's sheet after sheet, I'll admit, I'll probably fall asleep. Honestly, it will just bore sure. the crap out of me. And I'm just being honest.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's wrong. It's just the way I'm interpreting it, yep. right? But if it's done maybe with a bit of fun, right, or although of a serious nature, and the slides or the sheets or whatever you want to call them, you know, have a bit of color in them and a few pictures and stuff like that, and it's brought down to its bare simplicity, then I'll pique my interest. And then for me, I'll get more out of it and okay. I'll do better yeah. at it. Rather than sort of, you know, sure. that type of thing. And I'm not saying that's how everyone's going to feel, of course.
No.
I'm not putting in any methodology down, but simply that by bringing it to its simplest form, we'll come across quicker, be absorbed in here quicker, and give and reinstate more enthusiasm with the student. On a willingness to learn and better the self at it.
Yeah.
And we've proved that with this.
Well, and, you know, let's hop back in the conversation real quick to the point of intuition, especially when it comes to teaching that and really teaching the idea of being tied into that moment and trusting that. Because I think so many people, period, in the world, mistrust themselves. Horribly to their own demise frequently. They do not trust their own decision making, much less their own guttural instinct. You know, like you're saying, there's a lot of accept what comes through when it comes
you know
to
what?
Remote viewing.
You're spot on, Chris, because second guessing and overthinking is your nemesis.
Yeah.
With remote viewing. Just open up, put down what you're getting. Don't try to think about it because your left brain's kicking in then and all hell breaks loose. And I've done it myself a few times when I started off, especially, you know, you'll think of something. There's a great example given in remote viewing about your left brain kicking in and running away on a tangent. And it's you maybe sketch a rectangular type shape, and then you see there's liquid in it, and your brain will kick in and say something like swimming pool. And next thing you know, you're sketching little parasols and tables and chairs and people jumping in a pool, and everything's great. And it turns out it's a sewage plant. Now you add it there on a plate. You had something what resembled a type of swimming pool. So had you not jumped in and named it, and this is obviously why we declare the AOL, and just trust what you were getting, then maybe, not always, you would have got, oh, I'll dig deeper, foul smell, stench, toxic, chemicals.
Yeah.
You know, this sort of thing. Oh, hang on. Do a few movement commands. Obviously, as you know, very important. Oh, hang on. It now looks like more of a plant type scenario. You know, with all these chemicals, there's a lot of pipes. I'm moving across the other side, seeing a lot of this and different things. And how we open up from it.
Well, and even the fact of, like you were saying, you have very distinct things that pop up when a topic is happening, like when death is involved, you said, like things like Venus flytrap pop up for you, things like that. So there is something to be said about not getting too in your head about an analytic overlay. You know, because I mean, otherwise, hey, you know, you could go down all kinds of trails with Venus flytraps. But if you have had that imagery pop up in a session enough and understand that typically when you see this, the data brings you to the point of death in some way, shape or form, then you don't have to get caught up in that analytic overlay of seeing, you know, what does the Venus flytrap mean or anything like that. You can exactly, move forward.
Exactly.
At
I mean,
that point.
When I got that, and I obviously thought, right, biological, living thing. What does it resembles something like? At first, when I sketched it, I didn't know whether it was an old tackle, what had fell on the floor and got dog ears on it, or it resembled a Venus flytrap. But then I questioned, what are you showing me? Why am I seeing this? And then I was seeing the Venus flytrap, and there was an insect inside. You know, that's what happens. And straight away, it's obvious death. Very few escape it. So I just made a note. Death seems imminent. And then as I progressed with that particular session, other things came up. And then I would put many people. And then, of course, a story starts to develop, doesn't it? And then thrown in with the questions, which we must always ask, many of them, and the movement commands, you start to unfold your session, and it does start to piece together. And then with Vantage Point, we go on to another two different stages here, where we really do deep dives, and then it brings everything you need up, and then of course the all important summary at the end.
And let's start getting into the idea of the summary. How do you, because I think that is a huge part of the equation. Of course, I mean that's where you bring data together. But how do you coalesce together a good summary? Because of course, as a beginning remote viewer, which I am still very beginning, I've had maybe four or five sessions of remote viewing, Carl. I consider the fact that I still have a lot of broken data. You know, I still haven't fully learned to dig deep into something or feel deep into something. You know, like Brown. You know, something like that. It's still hard for me to dig deeper into that gestalt sometimes. So I end up with some broken data. And it can be hard for me to write a good summary for a case or for a viewing session.
Right. Well, you'll do your separate sessions. Then it all goes on to a master sketch with Vantage Point. Now, on this master sketch, you've consolidated all your impressions, all your descriptors. From there, now, a lot of the time I do this, I'll stand up and I'll actually think it or talk out loud. And I'm saying to myself and asking questions, well, are you first? Did you come after? Where is this? And it starts to really piece together where you're sort of moving, literally in your mind, moving pieces across the board. And then it all starts to fit. Then you ask more questions and throw in all your movement commands. You've really got to be the detective, the investigator, the psychic spy, not just the remote viewer. When you've done all this, then you've got questions, you've got answers, and you can compile it in the order it should be in. And then you open up for your summary, you get your feelings, you look at the data you've got, and then you type up, which is one of the more underestimated things in remote viewing, in my opinion,
yeah.
The summary, and
yeah.
So important.
And
I will sometimes do at least several paragraphs, and I start off with, right, straight from the start of the session, I was experiencing, you know, like a lot do. And then what you do is you type in that up, which obviously, as you know, can go to your monitor, your tasker, your manager, the client, very important, you know, paying client. And you want this in layman's terms and, of course, professional. And then you don't remember everything. So as I'm typing, I'll look over at the sheets. Ah, yeah. And then you type in again, and then, boom, you've got a really good session giving all your accounts of what you found, what you interpreted, how it made you feel, where you felt it was or what it was, and so forth. And it really, really, really does start to unravel.
Well, and, you know, once again, there are a few things that I think act as hurdles for people to want to get into remote viewing. One of them for me, quite honestly, Carl, is my 7-year-old draws better than me, you know, and I think people think you have to be like a Rembrandt or a Da Vinci to be able to sketch things out, and that's not the case. I mean, you saw my work on the remote viewing cruise. It's very elementary, very simplistic, you know, but as long as you can get things across and as long as you understand them, that's what's important. You don't have to be an amazingly detailed artist or anything like that.
Not at all.
To be a remote viewer. And we're about to show an image from a session of yours, which is a pretty choice session. We'll let you describe the session, how you became involved with it, things like that. But it's a prime example of how, you know, you don't have to be an amazing artist. You know, I will still say you're way better than I am as far as art goes. But you know, you don't have to be absolutely accurate or anything like that. I mean, you're very, very accurate here, but these are pretty basic shapes, things like that. Nothing incredibly detailed or shadowed, that kind of stuff. But how did you...
Do you know what I call it, Chris? I call it basic coloring book sketches.
Yeah.
Somewhat childlike, but they will suffice. If I'm drawing a person, biological, I will do a matchstick person. That's all you need.
Yeah.
Maybe arms up, arms down, out, holding something, or if they're moving, indicate with an arrow which way they're moving. Does it appear fast, slow, that type of thing? And that's all you need. If you're drawing a structure likened to maybe a house, just draw a block type shape, outline,
yeah,
and two curves. And that is all you need to tell yourself and your tasker or manager what it was. And then you can go on from there. Now, the slide you've put up, we actually use this in the training. As you can see, very, very basic, but also pretty spot on. And this one, ironically, I was remote viewing quite a few years ago for, I can't say too much, but for an American interest. They wanted locating a person of interest, one of the main men of a terrorist group. So it was quite serious.
Yeah.
And during the session, I just got took straight to this location, and it was like a bi-location for me. And I'm stood in the desert, and I can see this facility look like oil-type refinery plant. And then next thing, there was these explosions coming across from the right-hand side from the mountains, fire, screaming, and everything else. I literally had to jot this down very, very quickly. Now, what I did after it, I did a report, which you'll see some of the stuff's redacted on there. I can't show the report for obvious reasons. Actually, Uri Geller helped me with getting this to the right people. And
oh,
afterwards,
wow.
It got sent to the White House. It got sent to the CIA and the Saudi military intelligence. Now, this was on the 14th of August, and it was 1 month to the day of the 14th of September that that explosion and attack occurred. So things can be very important, but still the emphasis being simple childlike outline sketches will suffice to give yourself and other people a general idea of what was going on.
Well, and you know, this is, once again, a fascinating case and very interesting. And I know you can't go into incredible detail, but was this an intended tasking for you from somebody?
No,
or was this something that,
was actually,
something that came to you you were doing a remote viewing session?
I was remote viewing in a European country, right?
Okay.
For one of the top brass of a terrorist organization. They wanted him located, right? So this American interest and I had teamed up to do this. And literally, I was in the guy's apartment in the remote viewing session. I was picking up on his health issues, his escape route, and detailing it all down. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, just got woof. And I was in the middle of the desert looking at this oil refinery, and then the attack occurred.
Wow. Wow. This
took me by surprise.
Well, and it's really interesting because when we were on the cruise, we did what's called an outbounder, which is where you tie into somebody that is at a location. And it doesn't have to be a location that's in present time. It can be a location in past time, things like that. So it wasn't necessarily that the gentleman that you were searching for was at this location, but even the fact that he had been at this location or was part of this attack, things like that, those are the things that come through. And it's fascinating to me, the idea that, that yes, a session is not necessarily bound by time. It's not necessarily bound by space. So the idea that you picked up on this while you were searching for him is fascinating and really, really shows the depth to which a session can go. Now, did the intelligence help find said individual?
I can't say anything about that.
And that's understandable.
And you know what? They wouldn't tell little old me anyway.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Unless there was some sort of announcement from a podium somewhere, you know, or from a lectern on TV,
yeah,
like we get, where it's like, oh, you know, we killed him. it's
yeah, we got the
like
stuff.
You're announcing the lottery winnings or something, but. It is interesting to see that once again, while you're in session, the things that can come through and the way that you process that, because once again, once this information came through on your session, things hit a different rung with connection and who got a hold of this information.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I literally grabbed a few blank sheets and just started sketching and writing down as it were coming through as fast as I could.
Wow.
And I think if you zoom in, Chris, on the time there at the bottom, I'm trying to see what there we go. So 28 minutes.
Wow. Wow. And that really shows you the fact of, like, it's not an all day scenario, a good session, you know, it can be very, very quick, you know, and I have seen people, within 2, 3, 4 minutes get pages of data out, pages. Yes. And I am nowhere near that adept. Once again, I am very beginning in my remote viewing journey. But even the things that have come through for me, and I had a prime example of the AOL experience on the boat during our outbounder when we were doing the piece of Keith Haring art. And I'll have to find my pictures someday and actually add them to my system.
You got some great data on that one, mate. You really did.
It was good, but at the same token, there was a moment where after I drew the circle and put the spokes on it and had the triangle coming out of the beam, I began going down the road of it being a turbine and it being a power plant. And my brain just went down that road and kept a tumbling. And it's like, had my monitor that I normally have been there. And Angela was a fantastic monitor. She pulled a lot of information out of me during that session, a lot. It was amazing to see her work. And it really goes to the point of, and I know a lot of people that remote view on their own, sans monitor, Carl. And that is perfectly fine. But there are some people out there that having a good monitor pulls so much more out.
Absolutely. And this is what I say, like with the intuitive, although a monitor isn't, it's anything and everything what will give you your best guidance, collate the best and most data and impressions, and overall get you the best remote viewing session correlating to that feedback.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it really is all about the feedback, you know, because once again, do you personally work with a monitor, Carl?
No. I've tried one.
Prime
it's
example.
For me.
Prime
I
example.
Actually find it off-putting. But as you say, you work well with one. And this is the key to a bespoke session of getting everything in place of what the individual remote viewer feels good with. And that pays dividends each and every time. Like, for instance, if you and I had to have monitors, I know I'd do terrible because it would be a distraction. I wouldn't be able to focus. You'd do a great session. Then maybe if we took the monitors away, we'd do an equal session, one more than the other. Who knows? But it's getting what the person feels comfortable with. So any and every way, it's a personal choice. It really is.
Yeah. And you know, I think once again, something that every RVer out there should explore, you know, the idea of having a monitor and see if it's for you. I once again am very beginning in my journey. So it may be the fact that in a few years of practice, things like that, I don't necessarily need a monitor to rein me in the way that I do now. But it's interesting to see the different ways that people approach a session. And when I saw you on the boat, on the cruise, approaching your session, it was a completely different way, than what I'd seen other people at the conference doing, Carl. And you were one of those folks that in a short amount of time got a great amount of data onto a piece of paper. Walk us through a session in your brain, Carl. How does a session work for you? How does a session begin? How does it run through? And how do you wrap it with summary?
Right. So obviously, the difference between that and CRV, where, as you know, it's got your various stages, strict protocols, and CRVers won't usually know the target because they're sticking with the protocols all the way through. And that's fine. If that works for you, that's great. With an intuitive process like ours, you will generally have an idea what that target is within moments of putting pen to paper. You may be off and you may have to come back in a little here and there, mix it round. But that, of course, is where your commands and your questions come in. And you'll write a target number down, so 7342-9861. Push, right? I don't use ideograms, but I do teach them, and I teach them probing, and I teach them also non-dominant and going over the ideogram. And if I do an ideogram, which is rare, I never probe to get any impressions. I just non-dominant and over the top, and that's where mine come from. Again, bespoke to whatever's natural.
Yeah.
I will get far more doing that because it just doesn't work for me very well with a pen. I don't feel comfortable. I get stuff, but I find it slower and more difficult.
Mm.
And again, I'm trying to emphasize on simplicity being the key of everything. So I'll do like you doing yours, literally from the target, start getting a few sketches, a few shapes, different impressions, write a few descriptors down, you know, maybe how I'm feeling, is there an atmosphere I'm picking up, smells, colors, temperatures, the usual stuff. And then I'll sort of pause. I call it going in and out the session. And then I'll look over it and then I'll move my hand over it again and then pick up more details. And bit by bit, this will piece together. And then you can do a brief, maybe if it's a quick one in your head, maybe a one paragraph, two paragraph summary just thrown in your head before you even write it down. And what you're doing is walking yourself through from start to finish. You're rearranging the pieces on the sheet or on the board, so to speak. And then in your head, you're thinking, right, what is this? What has just happened? How is it piecing together as I perceive it? And there you end up with your summary. It doesn't mean it's right all the time, Chris, of course.
Oh, sure.
Nothing's 100%, but that's how it generally works.
Well, and you know, the part of not being right, hugely important, Carl, because you've got to accept the fact that you're human. Like even a sensor is wrong every now and then, you know, even a motion sensor is wrong every now and then. We all get, because I even made the joke on the boat in numerous interviews, like nobody remote viewed the hurricane, you know, but there is the concept of even with many of those things, like our decisions change, a human's decision changes. Like you may remote view this guy that you were looking at in one location, but it doesn't mean that he on the way to that location didn't decide he wanted a hamburger and is now taking a different route. You know,
exactly.
Something like
exactly.
That. There are quantum things that get in the way. Now
of course.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that you're wrong, but it definitely means that, you know, something else is there. And you know, even the idea once again of that analytic overlay, not possibly being wrong. Many people consider that quote invasion on a session as something wrong with the session when it may actually be a key detail that you're not aware of.
Absolutely. You're right, Chris, because accept it with open arms, right? Don't try and fight it or beat yourself up. Oh, another AOL, I've named it again, because that isn't going to do you any good, right? It's counterproductive. Look at it and go, oh, great, okay. So I've seen some sort of man-made structure and I called it a factory. I shouldn't have. Write it down, make sure you declare it, and then just move on.
Yeah.
The lesson is really don't think. Just do it. right? A great person who I love to bits has a phrase, just do it, right? And it is so true to tell your brain that, you know, don't think it, just do it, exclamation mark.
That's right.
End of. I got asked on a podcast a few months ago, when do you think, the guy interviewing was learning, he said, when do you think I should practice, 3 times a day, 6? And I said, well, I can't answer. And he asked why, and I said, it depends on you.
Yeah, I'm not
You're different than me. If you've come home from work and you've had a crappy day with your boss, don't remote view. You're tense, might be in a bit of a bad mood or something.
Yeah.
Leave it. If you feel nice and relaxed, you know, maybe you're on your own and, oh, this is super chill. You've just had a nice soak in the bath or a nice shower and you're feeling really sort of, oh, yeah, I'm going to kick back. Then try one, because you'll be in a nice frame of mind, relaxed. So, and I was trying to explain to him, it depends on the individual, the mood, the environment, the day you've had, you know, what's happening in your life and so forth. But you're quite right with the AOLs. A lot of people misunderstand them and are afraid of them. And another key with remote viewing, from my point of view, is don't beat yourself up. If you get it wrong, just go back and look and go, my God, I sketched something, what had 9 pointed sides and it's turned out it's a beach ball. You know, don't kick yourself. Have a little giggle about it, loosen up, and then, and here's the key, look at your feedback and look at your session and try and visualize, where did I start to go wrong here? Where did I start to run off on a tangent? Where did my left brain kick in?
Yeah.
And I allowed it to. What can I learn? And any mistake in life we all make.
That's right.
What can I learn from it? That's the key. Don't fuss about the mistake. It's been made. It's washed under the bridge. It's gone. Focus on how can I avoid that in the future? How can I learn from it? And that's how we advance.
That's right. I mean, you've got to accept that the mistake was made and you have to have a plan for when the moment of mistake comes again. You know, because it's going to happen again. You're going to have another AOL. It's going to happen, you know.
Exactly. I got the line coming down. Do you remember me telling you? And it curved, and I kept getting China in my head. And I sketched the front of a Chinatown. I was doing a Bob Ross. Oh, I'll add this and the Oriental roof. And I was really chuffed with it. I thought, this is great. And the feedback was a mountain range. And I was gutted. And I thought, what happened? And when I'll check the feedback, and here's the thing I always say about this, I noticed that the key feature in the mountain range went down and slurped up, and the mountain range was in China. So I thought, you shouldn't have had your left brain kick in.
Yep.
I should have AOL'd it of, oh, it's an Oriental type traditional roof. And then you went on to sketch Chinatown. Rookie mistake. You just smile about it and learn from it.
Yeah, because it happens, and it's bound to happen again. You know, even the best viewer has a bad session. Even the best viewer has a bad day. And I guess that is one of the important things about feedback, is learning to realize when you had a bad day and where that day went bad, you know.
Exactly. And a lot of people, a good instructor will say, look, when you get your feedback, make sure you go over it. You know, look at your session and learn from it. And a lot dismiss it. Oh, I did terrible. And you never should. You should go over it, because you will learn from your mistakes.
Yeah. Now, with that in mind, we're getting close to the end here. A couple more questions, but how do you prepare your data, Carl? Once you've had a session, once you've got all of this, how do you go about, I guess, databasing that? Do you database your data? Do you compare and contrast your viewing? And this is just session to session. Do you compare and contrast your sessions in that kind of way? Like, have I been better in grasping color than location lately, things like that?
Well, It's a good point, that, Chris. And no, I don't really. I used to look and give them a 1 to 7 on the TERG scale, which you're familiar with, although I don't. But to be honest, I was doing that many sessions. There just wasn't time to, sort of, you know, compose and file all of this. So what I used to do was just go over it and make a mental assessment. Oh, well, you shouldn't have run off on an AOL or a tangent. You know, mental note for next time.
Yeah.
Focus more on the task at hand in the session. Trust what you get and don't overthink it. So I would sort of have a sort of mental teaching process going on. Oh, you didn't do very well on that one, did you? Now you know why. That was the key to me. Yeah. I didn't mind failure, and I don't mind failure. I want to know why I failed.
Yeah.
Or why I didn't come up to scratch. And once I know that, I can tell myself, right, you shouldn't have done this, or you shouldn't have done that. You just run away with it. You should have kept your focus. And I'll go, next time.
Yeah.
That, to me, is my learning process.
Yeah, the pattern recognition is hugely important. You know, you've got to understand, when you have that moment, why you go down that rabbit hole. Because otherwise, if you don't understand why you go down the rabbit hole, it may be hard for you to ignore the rabbit hole, you know. Rabbit holes are very interesting. There's all kinds of things down a rabbit hole, man. All kinds of things. The question is, are they on target, you know? That's the problem, is that is the rabbit hole on target? And sometimes, yes, the rabbit hole is on target, you know, but I was just curious because it's one of those, I say regularly whenever I speak at conferences or on shows, one of the reasons I love remote viewing is the data, above any other, psychometric science or, you know, parapsychological science or study out there. I think remote viewing has more lab work done on it, more actual graphical data where things are categorized and things like that. And it's fascinating to me, especially having studied with Lynn Buchanan, the idea that, you know, he has like a chart of students and who is better at different things. You know, like,
again,
who is better? Like, okay, so we're being tasked with a target. It's going to be a hard target, not a soft target, and not like a person hitting the target. This is going to be like a hard location. So who's better at sensing a hard target over a human target? Who's better at sensing, you know, natural things over man-made things like that. And it's really interesting to me to know that there are databases out there like that there are tons of repositories of this kind of stuff. So
absolutely.
Yeah. It's interesting the fact that there has been so much scientific work in that field and that side of the field. So.
Without a doubt. It's amazing what there is. And the only other thing I'll say to people learning is, don't beat yourself up on a bad session. Learn from it. And when you do a good one, don't let ego come into it. Just pat yourself on the back. Again, know why you've done a good session and then move on with positivity.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I will, and you know, once again, I am no adept. I've had maybe 4 or 5 sessions. But I've definitely patted myself on the back in a few of those sessions where it's like, whoa, that was some major hit territory. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
But I'm also fully willing to accept the fact that I was way off target.
That's right,
I was nowhere near target for that. So, as we get ready to let you go here, Carl, how can people get involved? How can they, I know we've got a training session coming up here in Austin, with Vantage Point. Where can people go to get a hold of you? Where can they go to find out more about Vantage Point training? And where can they go to one of the upcoming in-person trainings here in the States?
Right. Well, the webpage is vantagepointrv.com. I'm just looking at the post-its here. April 11, 12, and 13, we're at the Radiant Living Center in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Then the 25th, 26th, 27th of April, we're at Nature's Treasures, Austin, Texas, where we'll be seeing you. And then May the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, we're at the Shadow Valley Holistic Center in Oakmar. That's in Oklahoma. There are just three of them. We're discussing more as we tour around the United States from very early April. And I'd just like to give a quick shout out, if I may, Chris, to Michelle Fried at LITM Media, who has done amazing with getting these gigs sorted, securing the venues, the prices, negotiations, and everything else. And anybody at all interested in getting a good top-of-the-range publicist, then go to LITM Media.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I have worked with LITM for years. Michelle is absolutely fantastic. And the fact that you guys are working together on these events brings it all into an amazing light, because it really is about team. It really is about who can you work with to get a proper message out there. And I think that especially when it comes to things like remote viewing, things like mediumship, that kind of stuff, Carl, sadly and horribly, there are all too many charlatans out there. There are all too many people who are ready to absolutely take your money for the afternoon and give you nothing more than a more shrouded veil of what to do, how to do things properly. You know, so people like you, people like Michelle, who herself is a remote viewer and works with IRVA, the International Remote Viewing Association, you know, seeing the two of you guys do this, I think is fantastic, because it's a couple of people that are coming at it not only from the proper educational point of view, but the proper point of view as to what remote viewing is used for.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for the time. I greatly appreciate it. Thank you. I can't wait to see you in person. I can't wait for the upcoming training. It's going to be great. Hold the line.
We're looking forward to catching up again, Chris.
It's going to be a fun weekend, I guarantee you. So
cheers, Nick.
Absolutely. Hold the line real quick while we close things out. While you are online, everybody, checking out Vantage Point Remote Viewing at Vantage Point RV and getting your tickets for the upcoming remote viewing training at Nature's Treasures here in Austin. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. That is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can comment. That is where you can go to curiousrealm.com/videos and find all of the embedded video channels of our guests. You can also go to curiousrealm.com/store and buy any of the books or classes from our guests, as well as your copy of the Curious Research Field and Observation Guide. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, UFO, UAP studies, stop on by, get your copy of the Field Observation and Data Log. It is your back pocket companion to gathering all of your data on site as it happens, so that it is prepared to shake hands with science come the day that you needed to do so. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without that, humanity doesn't march forward at all. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening, stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.